You're listening to the Thoroughly Good Classical Music Podcast. My name is John Jacob. In this episode, you'll get an opportunity to discover Handel's Oratorio Israel in Egypt, scored for double chorus, orchestra and soloist. The work depicts all manner of infestations, including flies, frogs and hailstones, and the River Nile turning to blood, in addition to the parting of the Red Sea. All of this scored by Handel in 1738. It's one of the works that the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra are revisiting in performances in Catalonia, Luxembourg, St. Martin in the Fields, Hamburg and Versailles in March and July 2024 to celebrate the group's 60th anniversary. In this episode, you'll hear extracts from those rehearsals and the Monteverdi Choir's original live recording from 1995, plus performers Amy Wood and Nick Pritchard discussing Handel's writing, their work and what makes a trill sexy. First, director Peter Whelan kicks things off with a succinct description to whet your appetite.
So it's a biblical story, and I think as far as Handel is concerned, he's telling a tale that everybody knows, almost like a fairy tale. It's about this terrible plague that happened to the Egyptians, and he just paints it in the most vivid colours possible. It feels to me, and people will have different takes, but it feels to me like a Roald Dahl version of telling this particular tale.
My name's Nick Pritchard. I sing tenor in, well, quite a lot of early music and some sort of modern-ish repertoire. Why I do it? I guess it's the communication that kind of speaks to me the most. I am also a bit of a music nerd, which is good territory for early music. Yeah, it's the connecting of people. I think that's not why I started doing it. I started doing it because I just love listening to music for years and years. I still do, you know, when I was young. But the more I do it, the more, yeah, I find it's the stuff that happens between the stage and the audience that keeps me in it, I think.
The thing that is difficult to put your finger on.
Exactly, yeah, and that's different anytime you get up and do it, really. Depends who the audience are, depends what the piece is, what you had for breakfast that morning, all those kind of things, how much sleep you had, how much time your three-year-old daughter was allowed you to have to yourself this morning.
Are you complaining?
Not at all, no, not no, at all. No, this is the rich tapestry of life.
Nicely responded to. Deftly, I might even add.
My name is Amy Wood. I'm a soprano in the Monteverdi Choir and in various other London-based groups. And why do I do it? It's such a great question. Because I love it. And to a certain extent, I feel like there's nothing else I want to be doing. I do have another job, actually. More recently, I became a psychotherapist, which is great. But if anything, it made me even more grateful for this job and for music and how it can transport me out of my stressful London life. And, for example, in this piece, take me maybe to Egypt, although it is quite stressful there as well in the piece.
Surely not suggesting it's only a tourist destination.
My name is Peter Whelan. I'm a conductor, director on this particular project, and I do it because I love music, I guess.
I mean, I know that you love music. Obviously, you love music, but why do you do it?
I mean, it's not something I'd say out loud very often, but it does feel like a vocation. I just can't imagine doing anything else.
Tell me about the work. What can I, as a newcomer to it, expect?
Drama, and a lot of it.
We're in for a treat with this work because it's really wonderful. This one truly is spectacular, I think that's the word for it.
So you hear a whole range of emotions and the relief of escaping the trauma. So the Israelites kind of being so persecuted in Egypt and being saved and escaping and finding that salvation.
It was the first piece, or one of the first pieces I remember noticing on TV when I was a teenager, with kind of an early music group, was John Elliott Gardiner's ensemble. And I remember recording it onto VHS and watching it so many times that eventually the tape ran out, much to my disappointment. So it feels like coming full circle to do the piece again now. But I suppose the reason it spoke to me is just because it's so flashy, exuberant, heart on sleeve, and just a lot of fun as well.
And you heard it first as a teenager?
Yeah.
Did you come from a musical background? Or?
No, I wasn't from a musical background at all.
It's quite specialist. I'll describe it as specialist, quite niche to be responding to as a teenager.
Yeah, I had piano lessons with a neighbour, and then was kind of interested in classical music when it came up on TV, and then I kind of drifted towards Baroque and kind of historical performance. I don't know, it just spoke to me, or it's a kind of music that I enjoyed. And I guess that's.
Did that make you unusual amongst your peers?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Maybe, and like also my parents didn't really know what I was doing. Maybe it was a way to be different or to set me apart. I don't know, I hadn't given it so much thought.
It's a potent work given present day events.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it does really, I think, amp up your approach to those emotions when you see them all around you. It really, it's very, in many ways, you have to protect yourself. You want to go into these emotions in order to convey everything, but you do have to be mindful as well about how raw this all is at the moment in the world.
Things that look backwards, like the work we're doing at the moment, so the historical performance approach or old music, and listening to it again and trying to make it sound as though it were new, like the ink was still fresh on the page. I think there's something attractive about when the world is so uncertain and unstable, there's something comforting about looking to the past and the beauty of the past and refreshing that and hearing it with new ears. I think it's that's something that happens when the future is uncertain. I mean, the early music movement started quite strongly. It was going in the 19th century, but it was after the wars that people really got into it as an alternative to where we're at. So I think for this point in history and all that's going on, it's extra important.
You talked about the emotion in it. Do you hear that in, so for somebody like me on the outside, do you hear that in the melody or simply in the words?
Both. I think Handel's so good at that, that you hear it in every note, every rhythm, every word.
And is that adulation or is that is there evidence? Were you saying that out loud thinking, I know what he's going to ask me next? But because I hear Handel's music and I hear it's going to sound like I'm being really disparaging now, but I hear a lot of repetition, I hear a lot of sweetness, I hear a lot of, you know, it's immediate writing. He wants the audience to feel included. Mm. But because of that, perhaps I find the emotion musically difficult to put my finger on. Does that make sense?
Absolutely makes sense.
I feel like an idiot saying it out loud. But
no, I think that's so true, and I think it's our job as the performers to never sing it like it's repetitive or think of something like the Hallelujah chorus. You could literally just sing Hallelujah, you know, you're not really thinking about the word that you're singing or
and that is how I experience Handel, or that's how I perceive Handel most of the time. Mm-hmm. I think in sense the Hallelujah chorus is, you know, it's a bit of a PR problem for Handel. I mean, that's my opinion, it's not based on any fact, but there is emotion in the melodic line then for you.
I mean, the Hallelujah chorus, I don't know why I brought that up, because I sort of...
Wish you hadn't.
Yeah, well, it really can get repetitive, and I think that is when you have to check yourself as a performer. Okay, I remember one year where I did something like 14 performances of The Messiah as a choir member.
God, you must have been sick of it.
I mean, it was a real challenge to not be, and then to not convey that to the audience. So it's, you know, this job is, we're so lucky to be doing this job that the least we can do is come at it, you know, never sing, our conductor was saying yesterday to us, never sing a repetition of words in the same way. Approach it differently. Think about it differently.
The brain expects to have its expectations subverted. So there is an expectation on you to do just that.
Yeah. But it is difficult. And I will I will say that there are pieces where it's harder to keep that freshness and to keep that sort of newness to it. But personally, in this piece, I think, certainly based on the rehearsals we've done so far, I don't think there'll be a second of I really hope not.
You're really selling it. The thing that I've noticed in rehearsals is that everybody has to deliver quite a lot of detail. I mean, Peter directing cello and bass in quite specific detail about how a chord is played in order to set you up for the word blood.
Yeah, yeah.
And the amount of detail required just because there are three different sounds in that one word.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fairly standard for this, or is that fairly standard for the way you work?
It's, I for my money, it's vital for this kind of thing, particularly with recits. You know, it's so easy to just look on the page, you see a few words, some not very exciting chordal progressions, and then you've got a continuo team, which, you know, sometimes could just be a cello and a harpsichord. But as we were saying earlier, during those recits, the story is, you know, alive and kicking during that, and it has to move on. So you have to find so many more colours to lift it off the page. And they're always there, and there are so many different opportunities for colour within a continuo team. So here we've got a theorbo, double bass, cello, organ and harpsichord. So there's a lot of scope there. And of course, there are a million different ways that you can say the word blood, for example.
Yeah. You say blood.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Yeah, it's vital to cut and to tease out all these different things. And I think if you work on that sort of level, which I think you've got to really to produce good work, then no two different versions are going to sound the same.
There's very little direction really in the score. I was going through the vocal score. I mean, there's not very much to go on, is there?
Yeah, well, that's often the case with Baroque music, because, you know, the sort of performance directions and phrasing that we see in modern scores just didn't really happen. They were very, very sparing with tempo directions or anything. They often kind of work in kind of descriptive words rather than prescriptive words. So rather than saying this is how fast it has to go, it's kind of this is the feeling of this movement. And of course, how you interpret a feeling is different for any group or any performer or anything like that. And I think that's the beauty of this kind of music, I think, because it's so free in a way, I think, in those kind of terms.
You're right in that a lot of early music is very sparse on detail. It's kind of like a skeleton structure on the page, especially if you're dealing with somebody like Vivaldi. There's really little there, and for a long time, people thought that that meant his music wasn't that interesting, or he's writing the same concerto as Stravinsky said 500 times. But actually, once you learn a little bit about the rhetoric, or basically how you would sell the music to an audience, and what the where the harmonies go, what that might mean, it kind of gets under your skin, and you can really develop from the skeleton a full being. So it's a matter of reading into it and just knowing the tricks and how to make it speak and to the public. But so it means that there's not much in the parts, but there are several options and several ways to present something. So you have to give it some thought, give it some guidance, suggest what the way you think it might be. Somebody might come back to you and go, well, actually, my part does not suggest this, and you need to be ready to turn on a dime and maybe incorporate that.
So there is challenge and pushback in rehearsal?
Yes, there can be. I think in a healthy rehearsal room, there will be. But your job, or my job, is to get us from A to B. So you're directing it or driving the vehicle, and you can take on various aspects or opinions and personalities and you know, make the most of them, which makes the tapestry all the richer. But at the end of the day, you have to decide, yeah, this is, you know, you're driving the bus with all of these aspects on it from A to B.
It strikes me that you are having to sort of in your own mind renegotiate the hill that you're prepared to die on then, every pushback.
No, I
don't think it's quite so extreme as that. But
no, I think, of course, you have to have strong ideas, and it's good to have imagery at your disposal to help with the ideas. Because once you get into very small details that maybe lack colour, then you can get into trouble and the things can grind to a halt. But if you're keeping big picture ideas and keeping the breath going through the music, that can... cover up a lot of ills.
I'm immediately assuming that then makes it rife for people to be quite critical.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my God, you're laughing in a knowing way.
No, yeah, totally.
The industry and maybe amongst the audience, because if there's no one defined way of performing it, I mean, I know that can be said of any piece of music really, but if there's no clear direction and everything is open to interpretation, then my God, there must be a lot of backbiting.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, everyone has their opinions, and that's great.
That's
to an extent, that's great. Yeah. I suppose it does rub up against some people in different ways, depending how far you want to push something in terms of performance.
But who owns it in that performance?
It's a good question.
Isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think you've got to trust the performers, haven't you? You've got to trust the... It's somewhere between the... Well, everyone on the stage. Well, I say the rehearsal we were just doing, Peter the conductor, who's also playing in the Continuo team, so... he's as much a part of that kind of the organism of the Continuo team as anyone else, but also is kind of guiding the direction, the musical direction. You know, people have things to add, and that's the healthiest kind of music, kind of rehearsal room for me, when it's a bit of everybody, but there's somebody who is, you know, exactly, there's got to be a bit of that.
I missed the frogs. Nikki, the PR, told me that when I left the room to do an interview with somebody else, that I missed the frogs. Can you describe what I missed?
The frogs aria, or their land brought forth frogs, is just an incredible moment quite early on in the work that depicts, you know, one of the plagues, which is so bizarre, was that frogs just appeared everywhere, which must have been terrifying. But Handel painted in the most hilarious way, with counter tenor and kind of riveting strings jumping around. And the way he presents it is in real time. The musicians and the audience are in the moment seeing, and it's visceral. You can almost see and hear the frogs jumping around, and the counter tenor is like amazement at this. But it's a particularly funny moment in the work.
I wasn't at all. If you want to compare that, we could in this instance as well do kind of interesting. We can mix it up with the trills as well, and maybe sometimes it could be on notes and a little bit. As long as it's a section between both, then we can find.
The other thing I observed, which I may have misheard, now I've got you here, I can check, was you sought clarification on how to approach a trill. Mm. And I think I heard Peter say that the way in which you ended up doing it was sexy. Did I hear that correctly? I feel really awful saying that. But could you provide me with some clarification as to what was going on there, please?
Sure. Horses for courses, of course. I think in that particular context, so we were rehearsing a duet between tenor and alto, who are quite close in range. In fact, the alto will go below the tenor sometimes, and vice versa. So I think in that context where we were talking about double trills, both of us trilling at the same time, where we'd only be a minor third apart. So again, very close. And then if you, we're getting to really beardy territory here. Brilliant.
Carry on.
Good.
I'm in
safe company. That's lovely. So if one person anticipates where the trill is going to, so instead of going duh, duh, you go duh, 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 so that anticipation note. And if the other person isn't doing that anticipation, that creates a clash, a dissonance.
It sounds like a car crash.
It could do. Yeah. Okay. So I think that's what he means by the word sexy, which similarly says indeed. I'm British after all, no sex please. That kind of grinding up against each other, and I use that term advisedly, in the notes, that closeness I think is what he was getting at there.
I can sense that you're really uncomfortable now, so we'll move on.
Different question,
that.
Please.
Trills can be very sexy. Well, I think more than trills being sexy, there's the suspensions, which we're talking about a little bit. How you push into the blue notes can be a very sexy aspect. Handel is quite a sexy composer. Other ones, maybe like somebody like Boyce, is very competent and a great composer. I'm very fond of his music, but there's no sex in it. But Handel, despite his kind of lack of love life, as far as we know, knew a lot about the birds and the bees and what makes people tick.
I'm interested in leadership in music, both in the rehearsal room and in management. I wonder who are the leaders you find yourself responding to in the moment, be they conductors, musicians, or staff, and what is it about them that you're responding to, do you think?
In a general sense, I think actually with conductors, a quality that I really appreciate is them trusting us. So not being so prescriptive that they tell you exactly what specific sound they want in order to portray what their opinion of that emotion is. So I think when a conductor says, I remember doing some Brahms a while ago, and the conductor said, this section you're singing about being like a god, being Atlas or someone, and you're stepping on clouds up in the sky, and you've got these huge thighs, and I was thinking,
huge thighs.
It really stuck with me about the thighs.
What great detail, and also helpful.
Yeah, because then I respond to that image myself, and I convey that rather than that conductor thinking of how they want that to sound and then telling us how to sing it.
Almost like stage direction.
Yeah, basically. but it's that, I think it, in my opinion, it should feel like you're all collaborating together, not like you're delivering what a conductor pictures in their mind.
It sounds as though what you're describing there is two people, conductor and artist, meeting in the middle.
That's exactly it, yeah.
What element of that experience, I think that experience that you're describing is magical.
Well, I think going back to what we were saying earlier, it's somebody that can strike the balance between bringing a group together and enabling, that word comes up a lot in these kind of conversations, enabling people to bring their own experiences and sometimes expertise, feelings to a rehearsal room, while also guiding it with a fairly strong hand, because we've all been in rehearsal rooms where it's gone a bit too kind of free form, and there are too many cooks, and it kind of ends up with a little bit of a, I call it a sort of mezzo kind of effect in the end, where there aren't many bold colours, because everyone's sort of listening is a very good thing in music, but if you're wanting to follow everybody else at the same time.
It sounds like consensus.
Yes.
Lack of assertion.
I think yes, and okay. even and that's not to say those kind of atmospheres are unpleasant to work in, and of course, you know, quite the opposite sometimes, because it means that everybody is bringing everybody into the room, which is great. But in terms of focus and consensus, as you say, if you have a group of people working towards as a certain thing, whether it be a double trill anticipating over the bar, or a specific interpretation of a great work, whether it be something micro like that or something on a much larger scale, I find that a lot more exciting, and both as a performer and audience member, I think. So there's got to be a bit of that, but it's a really difficult balance to strike, and there's nothing you can. I don't think there's any way you can teach that in a leader.
Is it an intentional choice on the part of that person who is leading, do you think, or is it something that is just innate?
I think it has to be innate to a degree. Which is why what I mean by you can't really teach it, and it's such a fascinating thing, because you know so much. Again, the more time I spend doing work, the more I realise that this job and most others, I'd imagine, is about people management and connecting with people and bringing the best out in people. And that's just not something you can teach very easily, I don't think.
Well, who are the leaders that inspired you?
Like
I don't mean in terms of orchestral leaders, but as in leaders in general, because there is a distinct leadership style that you bring to the rehearsal room. I'm wondering who inspires you.
Oh, there's been quite a few people that who've been super inspirational. I had an Italian teacher called Sergio Azzolini. I was a bassoonist for 20 years of my life, and he was one of the first people to talk about this rhetorical idea or how much emotion can be hidden or packed inside this simple looking music. And he helped me to unlock that with that kind of Italian joie de vivre, that kind of spirit for life that the Italians have, that was super useful. Really loved working with John Butt within Dunedin Consort. He's an absolute genius who wears his knowledge so lightly, and he's such an imaginative person, and he just shares the information so readily, and he's not afraid to look daft when he's doing it. He'll give everything for the music. I find that just so refreshing. Like having worked in an orchestra for 20 years, you try to take the best of people. You try to be the person that you thought was missing, or you really hope to enable your musicians. You know, not too much control. You have to trust them. If you have a great team in front of you, you can loosen the reins and for the best results. If people feel that they're involved or they're able to play, then you'll get happy musicians and good music making, and that'll of course help the music itself and the audience to often pick up on that.
You have to be the person you think is missing. That's really interesting. What's that?
Yeah, well, I've garbled that Gandhi quote, but like you have to be the change you want to see in the world, and there are many. In my experience, conductors who had very little to say or are mostly interested in controlling the situation rather than letting it sink.